Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff from the Science Lab from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey guys, welcome to the podcast. This is Allison Loudermilk, the science editor at HowStuffWorks.com.
And this is Robert Lamb, science writer at HowStuffWorks.com. Tell me something, Allison. Do your kids play with sea monsters in the bathtub, in the swimming pool?
Not so much yet.
Yeah?
They got a couple of fish that squirt out water, which are pretty exciting. A frog that's getting a little moldy, to be honest. Nothing as exciting as prehistoric monsters of the deep, though.
Yes.
What about you? When you hit the bathtub?
In the rare happenstance that I take a bath instead of a shower, I tend to only have like an orange soda or an orange LaCroix with me. So I'm kind of out of the plastic sea monster phase. But when I was a kid, I mean, I still love giant sea monsters, but when I was a kid, I was really into them. And I had this book, which I actually brought in today, and we have in the podcasting chamber with us. And it was titled The Macmillan Illustrated Encyclopedia of Dinosaurs and Prehistoric Animals.
Yeah.
And it's fabulous because it's like every other page is like a double truck spread of these awesome prehistoric monster illustrations.
I had a lot of fun going through it, definitely, when we were picking out the animals that we wanted to feature.
Yeah, because it's dinosaurs, and then later on it gets into prehistoric mammals that are awesome, you know, because it's like giant horses and you know, killer sloths and things like that. And then there's a whole section with the sea creatures, the sea monsters, if you will. And they're amazing. I mean, the illustrations, they had several different illustrators, but a guy by the name of Colin Newman did the fish and amphibians.
Yeah, and all the animals seem to have a slightly different personality.
Yeah.
As you pointed out.
Yeah, it's like and don't get me wrong, they look very scientific. There's nothing cartoony about them, but there's something about the way they're drawn, yeah, where they have they seem to have their own little personalities.
Right, the Shonosaurus, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, kind of seems like it's almost smiling. It seems merry. It seems like a merry marine...
Like a merry fat dolphin.
Yeah.
Like I kind of expect... He kind of looks like he should be like dressed up like a 1920s billionaire, you know, kind of a Monopoly man, like going, like floating down the street in an underwater New York.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we get to some of the ancient rulers of the ocean that we want to talk about today, who's ruling the oceans today? Who are the big marine...
Who are the rulers today? Well, As anybody who's ever watched Shark Week can tell you, the great white is pretty awesome.
Great white is pretty awesome.
And how big's great white get?
Great whites can get about between 20 feet and 25 feet.
Yeah, it's pretty sizable. They look pretty fierce, and they can definitely chomp down on pretty much anything that gets in their path.
Yeah, well, I was wondering, when we were talking about great whites, I mean, great whites have been around for a long time, so I really wanted to check on that. And they've been around as long as 18 million years ago to 12 million years ago. And then if you look at the great whites' ancestors, they might go back as far as 50 million years ago. Okay. So it's not quite, but still, that's not quite as old as some of the characters.
Yeah, we're going
talk about
back
today.
Like double that for the guys we're looking at. And of course, as far as we're talking about sea monsters and just giant underwater creatures, because obviously creatures in the sea can be larger than the creatures on the surface because of they're suspended in water, etc. And so today we actually have the largest species, as far as we know, that has ever existed, and that is the blue whale.
Yes.
And what are the measurements on the blue whale? It's pretty astounding. Is that right?
70 to 80 feet in length, although they have one recorded at 106 feet. So that's pretty crazy. If you assume, 10 feet to a building story, so that would be equivalent to a 10-foot building.
Wow.
I'm sorry, a 10-story building.
Well, yeah, not a 10-foot building.
A 10-foot building, that would be kind of silly.
I knew what you were getting at.
Yeah, and they obviously weigh a ton too, as much as 150 tons. And the females, of course, are larger than the males, which is nice to hear sometimes.
Cool. Now, one of the distant relatives of modern sharks was the megalodon,
aka Big Tooth.
Yeah, and this one is a favorite I know of a lot of people out there, because there's actually a whole series of books, the Meg books.
I've not heard of those.
Yeah, it's forgive me, I can't remember the author's name offhand, but there's a series of them, and they're it's actually, I've never read one, so the fans will have to correct me if I'm wrong on this, but there's it has to do with like there being like a deep area of the ocean that's still warm, but it's cut off from the rest of the ocean by like a really like chilly layer.
Okay, so species evolving in isolation.
Yeah, so they have like isolation, and they're all like running wild in there, and then scientists, end up accidentally freeing them, and they run rampage, Jaws like, all over the ocean.
Wait, was this a Michael Crichton novel or no?
No, it's like it's another dude. And they almost made a movie out of it or something. But it's one of these where I think it involves like each book ends up involving giant sharks battling other prehistoric creatures, and it's part of this. I don't know. There seems to be this whole like subset of fandom on the internet where people are really into prehistoric sea monsters. And imagining what their battles, like their Godzilla-esque battles, would consist of, which is pretty cool.
What was that MTV show where they used to have the different celebrities battling it out in the ring?
Celebrity Deathmatch.
Right. So Deathmatch, except with
prehistoric monsters.
Right. So let's talk about some of the characters we're going to get around today.
Yeah, we're dealing with some legitimate prehistoric monsters here. We're shying away from the prehistoric sharks and getting into what a lot of people would probably say like dinosaurs of the deep.
Yeah, let's kick it off with the Shonosaurus. So as we were just talking about, let's imagine diving into the waters about 248 million years ago.
And let's go way back. This is the Triassic period, I believe.
Yeah. So let's imagine that we're going to dive into what is now present-day Nevada, except then it was covered in water. And you might have encountered this gigantic marine reptile that, to my eyes, like I said before, it looks like this sort of massive pot-bellied dolphin with a slightly sharper beak, as opposed to the more rounded ones you might see on a bottlenose dolphin today. But that sharper beak only had teeth at the front, which I didn't find particularly scary. So I'm not sure I'm going to qualify this as a legitimate monster, per se.
Well, still, I don't know, teeth only at the front? That's kind of creepy. If you were to smile at you, that would be...
It just reminds me of somebody having buck teeth, It's like... So back in 1928, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Seaman Muller discovered the fossilized remains of what we now know as the Shonosaurus popularis. And Muller discovered...
That's why he's so, proud-looking. He's a popular dude, right? Is that what that means in Latin?
A popular Shonosaurus, I think is what they're getting at, but sure. So Muller discovered them in this area of Berlin, or what is now Berlin Ichthyosaur State Park. But the serious digging didn't start until the 1950s with two guys, Dr. Charles Camp and Dr. Samuel Wells from Berkeley, which does a lot with dinosaurs. And these two gentlemen unearthed about 40 ichthyosaurs, discovered in different locations throughout the park. And of course, in 1989, the Shonisaurus popularis achieved its place and fame. It became the Nevada state fossil.
Oh, awesome.
So good for them.
I have to admit, I didn't know that we had state fossils.
I didn't either. I also learned recently that we have state insects.
Well, I think I knew that, but state fossils is new. I wonder what George's is.
I don't know.
I don't know.
So the Shonisaurus belonged to the order Ichthyosauria, which means a fish lizard.
Okay.
So if you were to look at it, it had four paddles, kind of like the flippers that you see on dolphins today, mm-hmm. and it had a fish-like tail that barreled it through the water. How big is big? Like 49 feet, roughly 15 meters, according to some measurements.
And that's about double the length of the larger great whites.
Yep.
Put that in perspective.
And so that was for one particular species, the popularis. And then they unearthed another species called the Sicheniensis. And that might have been even bigger. So the Shonisaurus breathed air just like dolphins do. But the Shonisaurus didn't lug its massive body to shore to lay eggs. Instead, it gave birth to live young at sea, like its fellow ichthyosaurs. So this is pretty cool. I was reading that scientists unearthed the fossil of an adult female ichthyosaur giving birth.
Oh,
how cool is that?
That's pretty cool.
Fossil record was able to capture that. I think that's just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing if you can get one just sort of standing there, but when you get like fossil finds that involve birth or you know, eggs or like occasionally it'll be like two dinosaurs duking it out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so taken together, you kind of wonder why the ichthyosaurs, of which the Shonisaurus was one, died out, because there are some pretty highly successful animals. And they occupied, according to scientists, the ecological niche of today's dolphins.
Okay.
And so they were around for about 100 million years. So I would definitely say that's a good run.
Yeah.
So that's the Shonisaurus for you.
Okay.
I hope you guys have a good picture. And if you don't have a good picture of the Shonisaurus, look it up, because he's worth a gander.
Yeah.
We'll have to put some pictures up on our Facebook page.
Yeah, there are a lot of pictures out there, so surely we can find a few we can link to.
So let's move over to a different order, the Plesiosauria order.
Yeah, and this is where, I mean, the other guys were great, but the Plesiosaurs are where it really gets awesome. And the one I'm going to mention here is the Leopleurodon, all right? And this is when they really start looking fearsome. This doesn't look like a fat dolphin. Let's turn the page there so I can actually gaze upon him again. Yeah, this looks like something that would battle like Godzilla. like he's very, very streamlined looking. Looks kind of, if you've seen like a whale skeleton, you know, like the actual skull isn't big and bulbous, you know. That's kind of like the overall shape going on with the Leopleurodon. So it's very streamlined looking, has this like very sort of cruel looking head. Big, thick football player neck, streamlined body, and these massive flippers. And so paleontologists believe he was probably extremely maneuverable in the water and could move at different depths pretty easily, and was probably an excellent long-distance swimmer.
Okay.
And I've actually seen some, like, some computer-animated kind of videos where they show this guy and one of his relatives, like, just sort of, like, popping out of nowhere and, like, biting the head off of another underwater creature, which is cool. And I imagine that's what the end game of this was like. But I really dig the idea of him being like one of these long pursuit killers, you know, where he's like, he's chasing after him and he's just going to wear you down over time, which is actually kind of like early human hunters. I mean, in the sense that early human hunters did like a long pursuit of an animal and then eventually wore it out.
Right. Well, another possibility is that he could be engaged in those long swims to find a mate, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, these were probably guys that covered a lot of territory. Another part of that big, cruel-looking head he's got is he had some powerful muscles to drive the teeth into the prey.
What was its prey?
Pretty much anything it wanted, because this is a top predator.
And those are pretty rare, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, when you think about the structure of the food chain, you got a couple of folks sitting on top or animal species sitting on top, and then a whole mass accumulating on the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I like the explanation of it as a pyramid, you know. And at the bottom of the pyramid, you have is the thickest, and that's where you have all the plant life. And then as you move up the pyramid, you have the herbivores, the omnivores, and then the carnivores. So the guy sitting at the top is just like, you know, like one.
Or the animal, the other animal.
Well, yeah. Guy or animal. Well, you know, I'm using guy in a very general sense.
Sure,
The animal sitting at the very top of the pyramid on this, which I like to imagine being like on a throne of bones, you know, like he pretty much runs the show, but that whole pyramid supports him. So there's that's actually one of the interesting things when we get into looking at the fossil records, mm-hmm. and these like super predators and these top predators, is that there weren't that many of these guys out there compared to the rest of the biomass that was ruling the earth in those days. So we often have a lot less to go on. I should also mention that the Leopurodon, this was a late Jurassic creature, so about 213 million years ago.
Where have we found some of these guys?
They have shown up in, eastern England and northern France, dating back, again, about 160 million years or so. And, and this was pretty interesting too. Apparently there has been some misinformation about their size.
Okay.
Generally we're looking at about 39 feet in length. But there've been like a documentary or two that have exaggerated it to 82 feet.
Oh my!
Yeah, which is quite an exaggeration. And and I was reading up on this, and some of the reasons get pretty interesting. There's probably the internet's biggest
plesiosaur
fan is this guy named Richard Forrest, and he runs Plesiosaur Site. Which is just do a search for plesiosaur site and you'll find it. And he has a whole section where he talks about like some of these size controversies. And he says it comes down to like two different things. On one hand, again, you don't have a lot of fossil record for these big killers. So you kind of have to throw in some estimation, you know? Like a lot of times you're estimating their size anyway based on like their jaw size.
Extrapolating from there, sure.
And then also you're thinking like, all right, I have X number of skeletons of this guy, but this is not, you know, the one that I have here is probably not the biggest. So we can probably estimate that they get maybe 20% bigger. So then you end up saying, hey, the species can get to this length. And then also he said that if you're trying to get funding for your study, then apparently size matters. So you want to stress the size of your creature, you know? And then finally, he referred to something, and I love this, a process called Godzillaization, which sounds like you would want to say Godzillification. But
yeah.
At any rate, this has to do with the media picks up on one of these stories, mm-hmm. and the dinosaur.
Like the Predator X.
Yeah, like the Predator X, which we'll get into. Yeah, he just gets more ferocious with each media, you know? It's like Science Daily gets it, he's pretty tough. Then New Scientist gets it, he's even tougher, you know, and it like trickles down to finally people on the blogs are just like going nuts about how crazy this dinosaur is, or plesiosaur is. So anyway, I found that really interesting.
Well, to his point, to Forrest's point, I will say that when we were picking out the animals for this prehistoric podcast, I was checking out animals based on definitely appearance, but mm-hmm. also size.
Yeah.
I mean, the big ones, you're curious. You know, they kind of blow you away just off the bat. And then when you start getting into the different species, you know, of course, they all have their own really unique adaptations that are fascinating in their own right. But off the bat, if something is 42 feet, definitely. Yeah, that definitely. I thought, yeah, this should go on the podcast, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I tended to go first on just how ferocious and mean looking they were and then look and see how big they were. But it's kind of like, I guess they went through a similar thing with actual like land dinosaurs, you know, for the longest, everybody loved the T-Rex and that was, you know, it's whatever was biggest, whatever was baddest. And then kind of people got more into like, oh, velociraptors, which we did a whole podcast on that.
Right. And now velociraptors have their very own awareness day.
Yeah.
Take that, T-Rex.
So I wonder if with the prehistoric sea creatures, it's kind of like we're having the same process, but it's like a few years behind.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's still up in arms about the big ones. It's kind of like 1980s, like pro wrestling when everything has to be giant steroid guys, you know? So it's like we're still in like, oh my God, it's so big. It's like, let's look at how big this dinosaur is. It's like 50 feet. No, it's 80 feet. But maybe in like 5 years or so, we'll be really into the smaller predators of the in the fossil record.
Well, before we get into the smaller ones, I want to tell you guys about the Kronosaurus. And you guys might have heard about this one. This is another plesiosaur, and he was occurring in the early Cretaceous. So if you don't know when the early Cretaceous period was, that's about 144 million years ago for this particular guy, this particular Kronosaurus.
So we're creeping up closer and closer to the more modern sea life.
Right. And this was another marine reptile who's capable of reaching astounding lengths. This one clocked in at lengths of 42 feet. So take a moment and think about that. We can just throw these numbers around all day, but 42 feet, again, that's impressive. Imagine swimming at your local beach and encountering a 42-foot organism.
Yeah.
That's pretty astounding. So the Kronosaurus has been found, or fossils of the Kronosaurus have been found in Australia mainly. It's the biggest known plesiosaur. It had a flat-topped head. And if you think of a crocodile head, that's what to me it kind of looks like. It's reminiscent of a crocodile head, but it had those four flippers and it had this body that tapered off into a point. It wasn't a tail exactly, didn't have a lobed fin or anything like that, but just kind of tapered off. It was an excellent swimmer, like the Leopleurodon that Robert just mentioned. That is a really tough word to say.
Let's
just say like its fellow plesiosaur.
I have it like spelled out phonetically in front of me and I still keep tripping over it.
So it had to leave the water to lay eggs. And this was really one of its only vulnerable times. It had this big head, strong teeth, and jaws made it, you know, very formidable. But
and it's a really big head. Like it looks in the illustration, it looks oversized. Like it looks a little ridiculous.
Right. So we're sitting in this room that's maybe, I don't know, 10 feet by 7 feet. And the plesiosaur head, the Kronosaurus head, I think would just dominate this space, the head alone.
Yeah.
It's pretty insane. But if you're really interested in them, I highly recommend you go to the Kronosaurus Corner. And that's a site that you forwarded to me. And what that is the site for a museum. And it's a museum in Australia, specifically the town of Richmond in Queensland. And Kronosaurus Corner is part of Australia's dinosaur trail. Did you know that Australia had a dinosaur trail?
I knew they had some really cool fossils, but I didn't know that they had a dinosaur trail.
Right. So apparently they have established a route which you can go on and check out all the cool finds. And I was looking at the Kronosaurus site, and they have all these pictures of the different fossils that people have found. So apparently they might still be letting you dig and find stuff. I mean, you could come up with a Kronosaurus vertebrae or something, which thought was really cool.
And they have based on the pictures, they have like a giant, like fake Kronosaurus out front of the museum that you can, I don't know if you're allowed to climb on it. It looked like some of the photos people had climbed on it, but don't go climbing on it and blame us. But it looked really cool. Get your picture made with it for sure.
Yeah. If we have any Australian listeners who've been to this particular corner of the world, please send us pictures. We would love to see them. We'll post them on Facebook.
Yeah. And Kronosaurus Corner, by the way, that's a corner with a K because it's, you know, for branding purposes.
Yeah. Kronosaurus is with a K, corner, KK, I don't know.
Yeah.
Those Australians are always thinking.
Yeah.
So what about the Elasmosaurus?
Oh, the Elasmosaurus.
I love the way this guy looks.
Yeah, this one's really cool. This is, I guess the best way to describe it is, and I really don't want to take this in a Loch Ness Monster direction, but you know how the Loch Ness Monster is basically supposed to look kind of like that, except with a much longer neck. And if I were to take a quote from 19th century English paleontologist Dean Conybeare, he said that that the Elasmosaurus has resembled, quote, snakes threaded through the bodies of turtles. So, yeah, these dudes have really long necks. How long? They contain 28 vertebrae, and more than half of the animal's total length was neck. Like 26 feet was neck, and the thing's only 46 feet long.
Right. So if I'm whatever I am, 5 foot something, let's round it off to 5 foot four. That would mean that I had a, you know, more than a 2.5 foot neck, which is kind of hilarious. That would be tough with the podcast microphones.
But it could come in interesting as we'll see how,
how could that benefit me?
Well, they think that, obviously it would come into play, hunting.
Okay.
That's the big deal, obviously, if you're any kind of dinosaur or a plesiosaur. And they think it went one of two ways. One way would be that basically his head can get there before his body can, right? So his body's kind of hanging back here, and so he can sort of creep his head up to you before the waters are disturbed by his body.
Okay.
Which sounds kind of cartoony, you know?
Can kind of, you know, sneak his head around a corner, mm-hmm. and then if he sees something good, the body comes running fast. It reminds me of the Scooby-Doo cartoons,
yeah.
you know,
uh-huh.
where the legs are going so fast and they make that noise. You know, yeah. the Scooby noise.
Yeah, yeah. It also reminds me of like Inspector Gadget and the Elastic Man from Fantastic
yeah.
Four, you know, how their head would come around a corner on like a super long neck. And, you know, that's basically the advantage this guy would have. Another possibility, feeding wise, and this is one that we can back up with modern examples in the animal kingdom, involves the Elasmosaurus just sort of, you know, floating along the top of the water with his head all the way up. Right? Looking down.
So above water.
Yeah, above water.
So like the periscope of a subway kind of thing?
No, I think it would be more like the crow's nest on a ship.
Okay.
Except if you were like up in the crow's nest looking down and seeing what kind of fish are down in the water.
I see.
So he's got his head all the way up and he's looking down and seeing what's going on in the water. And then when he sees a fish he wants to eat, whoosh, you know, he just strikes down into the water with his head, long neck, grabs hold of it and has his lunch. And there's actually a bird that has a similar practice today, and it is called
a snake bird, right?
Yeah, an anhinga. And I looked up a picture of this guy, and you definitely get a real prehistoric vibe off of him. If you want to do a Google image search, it's A-N-H-I-N-G-A. And he's got this creepy long neck, and he just kind of sits, you know, up in the water, you know, kind of swan-like, ready to strike. And yeah, it's really cool. So that's one way they think this guy would have eaten. So that's the Elasmosaurus in a nutshell. But I found like one other like really cool fact about this particular prehistoric sea monster, and it actually takes place in the Old West.
Oh, give it to me. What you got?
All right. So and I was not familiar with this. This may actually merit a whole podcast at some point. But there was a period during the Old West known as the Bone Wars or the Great Dinosaur Rush. And this just comes to...
We should do a whole Rush series podcast because I also want to do one on the Uranium Rush of the 1950s.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah, if you guys have Rush ideas for podcasts. Besides gold rushes.
Yeah.
Or maybe we could do some interesting twist on Gold Rush. Besides, also, Sarah and Katie will have that for stuff you missed in history class. But tell me about the Bone Wars.
So this one is, you know, guys, you know, the Gold Rush, of course, was, you know, people rushing out into the wilderness because there's gold out there and we got to have it. This is more, instead of like grizzled old prospectors, this is like Yale educated paleontologists rushing out into the American West to try and find fossils.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, and to get the prestige and honor of, you know, of discovering these things. So you have two guys in particular, though. One named Marsh and one named Cope.
Okay.
Edward Drinker Cope. And these guys like were friends at one point, but then just totally had a falling out over competition for these fossils. And so they started feuding with each other. And when I say feuding, I mean they were resorting to bribery, theft, destruction of bones. They were attacking each other in the scientific publications, trying to ruin each other's credibility and sabotage their funding. I mean, these guys were getting really nasty about bones. And, so also they're, you know, rushing to get things done, right?
So what happened when they went to Kansas?
They went to Kansas and Cope found an Elasmosaurus, fossil. And so he starts like putting together the pieces and trying to figure out what the overall, you know, body of the animal looked like. And in his, haste, he managed to put the head on the wrong end. on the tail, so he ended up with the head on the tail.
That's unfortunate.
And then he sent this off, you know, it goes to publish. And when he finds out what he did, he starts buying back the copies at his own expense, so that nobody will see this horrible illustration that he presented. Marsh, his enemy, meanwhile, takes just rich delight in this and just starts like hammering him even more, even though Marsh later on made a similar mistake with a Brontosaurus skeleton. So, it sounds amazing. And there's actually a graphic novel account of this, titled, Bone Sharps, Cowboys, and Thunder Lizards, A Tale of Edward Drinker Cope, Nathaniel Charles Marsh, and the Gilded Age of Paleontology. It looks really cool. Check that out.
And that's by a guy named Jim Ottaviani,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, there's a whole comic book publishing house out there, and they just do awesome comic books about scientists. So
yeah, we'll have to put a link to that on our
definitely.
Facebook page. So what about some? I mean, we don't have to go all the way back to the Bone Wars to figure out some modern day controversy around fossil finds. What about Predator X?
Yeah, Predator X is the big one. Just came out last year in 2009 out of a Norwegian expedition, yeah, up around Svalbard, actually.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. And this was a study by Oslo's Natural History Museum, and they found these fossils, and it looks to be a 49-foot plesiosaur. Very similar.
Which they dubbed Predator X.
Yeah, dubbed Predator. Predator X is not the official title. In fact, it has no, like, official species. Name as of yet, no official classification. I guess they're still working on that. But
a lot of people are thinking that it's a plesiosaur, like the Kronosaurus.
Yeah, yeah. It looks very similar to the Kronosaurus and the Leporodon. I rushed through it, the pronunciation there, because it didn't have the word in front of me. But yeah, a lot of people think it's one of those two. Or not one of those two, but very similar, you know, except bigger. How big? They're saying that this guy would have weighed around 50 tons. With a foot long teeth and would be 49 feet long.
And its head makes the T-Rexes look like a bobblehead.
Yeah. And we keep picking on T-Rex. I feel kind of bad, because T-Rex, he's a land-based animal. It's like if you put him in the water and he evolved, I'm sure he would have been bigger.
That's true.
Yeah.
We'll lay off the T-Rex.
So the jury's still kind of out on Predator X, exactly what it was and what it was up to. But clearly it was some sort of massive, probably a plesiosaur and was, at the top of its food chain. So it's pretty, pretty awesome looking. So there you have it. We've run through four really cool prehistoric sea monsters and they're some of our favorites. You guys may have some favorites out there.
We'd love to hear them.
Yeah, let us know. And do let us know which one you think would win in a slugfest between various sea monsters of the deep.
Yeah, you can always send us an email at sciencestuff@howstuffworks.com or check in with us on Facebook at Stuff from the Science Lab or on Twitter at Lab Stuff. Hey, so what you got over there? You got some listener mail you want to share?
I have some listener mail. We recently did a really cool podcast on the Kardashev scale.
Yeah,
and,
we did.
This, to remind everybody, this is the scale, like type 1 civilization, type 2, and it has to do with energy usage of a planet and how you would, the different levels of technological sophistication for a civilization.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it shows up in science fiction a lot. So we put the call out to the listeners, hey, what's a good example of a type 4 civilization? Kardashev only covers type 1, 2, and 3. That's planetary, solar, and galactic energy. So 4 would be something beyond those three. So a
couple of you guys wrote in with ideas.
Yeah, yeah. So let's see. We had we heard from Marcus, and Marcus pointed out an example in the Star Ocean RPG video game franchise. He says, quote, it involves people who are in a type 2 civilization, but in the game, they have only just recently achieved type 2. And once they do, they right away discover intelligent life. The other civilization had always known about them, but rules had been made that type 2 should not interfere with the natural development of underdeveloped civilizations. So it deals, to a large extent with Kardashev classifications. Then we heard from Mo. And most says, quote, it seems to me that you could make another universe, that if you could make another universe, you would somehow tether to it and find some way of using that tether to generate power. If you needed more power, you would just have to either wait a bit or build more universes. If you don't solve your energy problems, one way to do it is to build another universe. So, and this is getting into, again, this is like crazy advanced, theoretical, science. And,
but I love how we just throw it out there. Yeah, let's just build another universe and harness the power from that.
Yeah, apparently they went into it in a there's a recent Radio Lab episode where it's like two Robert Krulich is talking to somebody about do-it-yourself universes and what that would entail. And certainly, if you could create another universe to generate power, that would, you would be at least type four, maybe, I don't know, maybe type five if it, to get, you know, real silly about it. Then we heard from Gary, and Gary said in Frederick Pohl's Heechee novels, I hope I'm saying that right because it sounds kind of silly. there is a race called the Foe who were type four. They were actively trying to collapse our universe into a big crunch in an attempt to re-engineer the universe when it big banged again into an all energy, no matter universe because it would be better for their form of life. I'd say engineering an entire universe from the start is type four. And then he also pointed out that there's some examples in the Stargate universe. But the stuff in Frederick Pohl's book, that's definitely type four. And that sounds pretty awesome. I really need to read some of his stuff.
All right. That's cool. We covered Kardashev scales, Monsters of the Deep. And if you want to read more about any of those things, check out our homepage at howstuffworks.com. And thanks for listening.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Want more HowStuffWorks? Check out our blogs on the HowStuffWorks.com homepage.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.